We now present the Bible for Today on the air, heard each week at the same time and over the same station, sponsored by the Bible for Today Incorporated and the Dean Burgon Society, with international studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D.A. Waite, director of the Bible for Today, speaking. Welcome to weekly broadcast number 525. 525 weeks of weekly broadcasting, standing together with the Dean Burgon Society in defense of traditional Bible texts, including the traditional Masoretic Hebrew Old Testament text, the traditional received Greek New Testament text, and the traditional English text, the King James Bible. We're building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today, and it's readable. The order phone number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. That's 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on a question and answer phone at 609-854-4452. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like you to get our book called Defending the King James Bible. Ask your bookstore to get that book for you, or call us direct. We'll tell you how to get it at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Perhaps you'd like to get an offer, free offer, that you'd like to receive, 1,000 titles defending the King James Bible. That's brochure number one. Simply ask for it as brochure number one. We'll be glad to send it to you. We're talking about the Bible version debate, the perspective of the Central Baptist Theological Seminary in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Central Baptist is so-called fundamentalist school and seminary shaping servants for the 21st century. And we believe in this area of the Bible version debate, they are misshaping servants for the 21st century. We're analyzing their booklet that they sent out and that they published during this year, 1997. And we're on page number 47. And we're talking about the New Testament Greek chapter 4, defining the terms by Dr. W. Edward Glennie. And Dr. Glennie is talking about a number of things. He's talking now about the so-called majority text. Well, we believe in the Textus Receptus, the majority text so-called. Presently, it used to be the majority text and the Textus Receptus were the same terms for the same identical manuscripts. But now, as of 1980s, 82, 3, or 4, when the Testament came out, the Greek New Testament, by Zane Hodges and Arthur Farstad, published by Nelson, they have sort of more or less taken that as a trademark majority text. They've almost copyrighted that term, and we don't agree with that majority text, so-called. That text has about 1,800 differences or changes from the Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible, and we don't believe that's the way it ought to be at all. We have several booklets on that, the majority text, why we do not agree with it, and one of them is seven defects in the more so-called majority text. The other is why I reject the so-called majority text. And then a larger book, of course, when the King James Bible departs from the so-called majority text. All these are available if you're interested in why we differ from the so-called majority text. Those are available at the Bible for Today here. We'll tell you how to get them if you simply call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. All right, we're on page 47. Dr. Glennie says, the editors of the majority text state that their method of determining the text of the New Testament is based on two principles. Number one, any reading overwhelmingly attested by the manuscript tradition is more likely to be original than its rivals. Well, that's, let's unquote, let me pause right there, that's certainly true. We would agree with that on the Textus Receptus side of the thing. But there are some verses, some particular sections, which are not necessarily in the majority of the manuscript traditions, which we believe God has preserved nonetheless. All right, let me continue. Number two, quote, final decisions about readings ought to be made on the basis of a reconstruction of their history in the manuscript tradition. Unquote. Well, I don't know about the reconstruction of the history. How are we going to reconstruct the history that we do not have? So I would question that particular basis of the so-called majority text people. Let me continue. Dr. Glennie says, what this means is that all readings in the Greek text are from the majority text type. Well, again, we're against the text types. We don't believe that there are such things as text types. There's certainly manuscripts, Greek manuscripts. We have over 5,255 as of 1967. There are more since then, but that's the total as of that date. And then he says, which is, according to their first principle, considered most likely to represent the original. Then Dr. Glennie says, however, the majority text type is not always united. Well, that's true. In fact, there are five distinct strands of manuscripts in this text type. Well, let me just talk about this text type and the strands. I don't believe there are strands in anything. as Dean Burgon has so aptly put it, the manuscripts are just the same as if you were to walk into a cemetery with, say, 5,255 graves. Let's just use that as an illustration. He didn't say that number. And every one of those graves is unmarked. There's no marking. You don't know whose body is related to what other body. You don't know whether they're completely related or they're completely unrelated. They're simply unmarked graves. And that's the way these manuscripts are. They're simply unmarked manuscripts. We can't say that they're five distinct strands of anything or a text type at all. We disagree with Dr. Glennie on that issue. He says, and the manuscripts of this text type often differ on individual readings. Therefore, Hodges and Farstad theorize the best way to find the correct reading within the majority text type where it is divided is by constructing a genealogy of the manuscripts. That's principle number two. Well, that genealogy principle is dead wrong. Dean Burgon had nothing to say good about it. He doesn't believe there's any such thing as genealogy because genealogy demands relationship. And it demands that one was related to another and one came from another manuscript, and we do not have that proof. As he says, unmarked graves. Every one of them unmarked. He says there are probably one or two, and that's about it. In the total of 5,255 that we have today, he didn't have that many. Dean Burgon in his day, 1888, long in there, when he died, up to that point. But he says that not a single one, maybe two or three at the most, can be said that one was related to another. So the genealogical argument is criticized by the so-called majority text people when it is applied by the Westcott false text. They criticize the genealogical method, but yet they try to use it when there's division in the majority text. And I don't agree with that at all. Let me continue. Dr. Glenn says, they constructed such a genealogy only for John 7:53 to 8:11 and the book of Revelation. Now, the ironic result of this is that the reading, which their genealogy or stemma of manuscripts indicates is the correct reading, is not the majority reading, 153 times in Revelation, and half of the time in John 53 to 8:11, that is 15 out of 30, unquote. Well, that's an interesting observation. I have never tabulated or totaled the thing up, but I disagree with using the so-called genealogical method as determining the factual basis of either Revelation or the woman taken in adultery, John 7:53 to 8:11. So, in fact, there's another majority text that is put out by Robinson and Pierpont. Dr. Glennie doesn't mention it, at least at this point, on page 47, but that one does not take the stemma or the genealogical readings in these two places, but takes what they consider to be the majority. Well, let me continue. Therefore, their two principles contradict, and their results demonstrate that to find the correct reading, the textual critic must do more than just count the number of manuscripts supporting each reading, unquote. Well, I would certainly agree with this in part, although number is a tremendous part of the analysis of do as far as manuscripts and as far as determining the Greek text of the New Testament. Dean Burgon says manuscript authority as far as antiquity is important. But on the other hand, there are other principles as well. He has a total of seven distinct principles, and every one of them is important. And they must be taken into consideration. Not simply the counting, but the counting certainly is a very powerful argument many times. Let me continue. No translation is based on the majority text. Although it is sometimes wrongly assumed that the New King James Version is based on the majority text, it is based on the same text as the King James Version, the text of Receptus. Well, unquote. I would say this, in at least two or three places I have found myself that it was not based on the text of Receptus that underlies a King James Bible, but based rather on the false Westcott and Hort type of text. But anyway, Jane Hodges, I am told, was very upset that Nelson did not publish the majority text Greek, and also as a basis of that, underlying that, the New King James Version. He wanted them to use his majority text, but they did not do it. I understand that there is an interlinear that is based on the majority text, and the text that is following that is the English text that would go along with his majority text, but this is not the case in the New King James Version. That is correct. However, some editions of the New King James Version, says Dr. Glennie, give majority text readings in the margin where such readings differ from the Textus Receptus. Unquote. Well, that's true. some editions, the study editions of the New King James Version, give not only the King James itself, as far as the text receptus readings, up on top of the page, but the New King James Study Edition also gives at the bottom of the page not only the NU, they call it NU, the National United Bible Society readings, but also the majority text readings as well. That's correct. Let me continue. Quote, the majority text, which represents the Byzantine manuscripts, is quite different from the eclectic text. All right, now that's correct. Differing from it in over 6,500 places. Well, I would say it was a little bit different than that. There are textual differences in the Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible in 5,604 places. 5,604 places. He's got 6,500. I don't know where he gets that. The majority text agrees with the eclectic text or the so-called critical text in many places as well, because it's 1,800 differences in the King in Textus Receptus itself. Well, he has a footnote on that. Footnote number 24. Let's take a look at footnote 24 to see where he gets this information. He gets that from Dan Wallace, some second thoughts on the majority text. Well, he says he has counted 6,577 differences between these two translations or texts. Well, he may count that many, and that's entirely possible. I would take it closer to 5,604 from the Textus Receptus, and if the New King James text, or rather the majority text, so-called, of Hodges and Farstad has 6,500 places different, well, that's news to me. It could very well be the case. I don't know that there are that many. At least I found the differences in Dr. Scrivener's Greek text between the text that underlies a King James Bible and the so-called Westcott and Hort text, I found 5,604 places where they differ. Let me continue. Cool. Two major differences between the majority text and eclectic text. Now, the eclectic text is the text of Nestle Allen, 26th or 27th edition, and it's also the United Bible Society text, or it's actually the Westcott and Hort text in very, very almost similar dress. It's the modern dress of Westcott and Hort because it's based upon two manuscripts, chiefly the Vatican B and the Aleph Sinai Aleph. So B and Aleph, the Vatican Sinai manuscripts. He says the difference between the majority text and eclectic text are their treatment of Mark 16:9-20 and John 7:53-8-11. Two major differences, unquote. Well, let's just pause right there. That's true, indeed true. And the problem is that the Mark 16:9-20 is genuine. That passage is genuine. And the text is proved by Dean Burgon's book, and we want you to get that. If you're interested in the proof of why the King James Bible is accurate in reproducing Mark 16:9-20, the last 12 verses of Mark, you should get this book. Ask your bookstore to get it for you, or call us direct. We'll tell you how to get it. It's called The Last 12 Verses of Mark, 400 pages. It's printed in a book, perfect bound. The Dean Burgon Society has reprinted this. It's available. Simply call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. We'll tell you how to get in touch with it and how to get a copy for your very own. Now, we also have a summary of the arguments in Mark 16:9-20, the vindication of the last 12 verses of Mark, in 39 pages. I have made a summary of Dean Burgon's larger book. Maybe you'd like that one. So either get the large book, which is preferable, the last 12 verses of Mark, or the small summary of that, the vindication of the last 12 verses of Mark. We'd be glad to send that to you. Let me continue. Quote, these passages are in trouble, or excuse me, are in double brackets in the eclectic text. Double brackets, unquote. That means that they are doubted in the so-called eclectic text of Nestle Allen and the United Bible Society text, or the Westcott and Hort text. But they're included in the text, in the majority text, in the text of the majority text. However, the majority text not only differs from the eclectic text, it also differs from the text receptus in about 1,800 places. Well, that is correct. It does. And the difference between these two texts is often blurred and not realized, especially in the arguments of the King James Version only advocates, unquote. Well, what's this smear term of the King James Version only? It's a smear term, and of course it includes not only the people such as the Dean Burgon Society and here our Bible for Today ministry, but it also includes the beliefs of Dr. Peter Ruckman, which we not agree with in many areas. on the King James Bible. And so this is a very strong and strange term, the King James Version only advocates. I don't blur the differences. I'm very clear on the differences between the text that underlies our King James Bible and the text of the so-called majority text. I have always stated that there are 1,800 differences, and this is very clear. Let me go on page 48. We're talking, my friends, on the Bible version debate, the perspective of Central Baptist Theological Seminary, and we believe that it's wrong. We believe that it's in error. The Minneapolis, Minnesota Seminary, calling itself fundamental, we do not believe is fundamental, and we differ with it, and we'll tell you why on these broadcasts. Perhaps you've missed some of them, would like the tapes of the other months that we've talked about this project. We'd be glad to find and tell you how to get these materials if you'll simply ask your bookstore to get them for you or call us direct at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. All right, we come to another division of Dr. Glennie's Chapter 4. Defining terms, and here he is, the textus receptus. He's going to define that term for us. Quote, the textus receptus, or TR, is the title given to the 1633 version of the Greek text edited and first published Erasmus in 1516. Unquote. Well, let me just simply say this. I don't hold that the textus receptus, or the received text, is necessarily restricted to the 1633 version of the Greek text, or the Erasmus text of 1516. The textus receptus is similar to the so-called traditional text that began with the original writings of Paul and Peter and John and James and the other writers of the New Testament. And the received text, textus receptus, is a text that has been received by all. That's the traditional text. And Dean Burgon's written an entire book on the traditional text of the Greek New Testament. And we have that in copy form. We're going to be publishing that soon, and we'll tell you about it. But if you're interested in that, we have it. And we also have a summary of his traditional text that's available. But we believe that that term should be defined somewhat differently. Let me continue. Quote, Erasmus was a Roman Catholic humanist who came to Basel in 1514 for the purpose of publishing his annotations on the New Testament with the text of the Latin Vulgate. Unquote. That's true. He has the Latin Vulgate on one side and the Greek text on the other in the Greek New Testament. I know he says Roman Catholic humanist, as if to smear Erasmus as right off the bat, and so that Protestants or non-Roman Catholics would be against anything that he produced. My friend, he was a Roman Catholic. That's no question about that. Erasmus was a Roman Catholic priest. And as such, whether he was a priest or not, he certainly was a Roman Catholic as far as his beliefs, as far as his church is concerned. But he was not what we call a good Roman Catholic, unquote, because he would dare to put a version of the New Testament other than Latin. He put it in Greek. And the Latin was the language of the Roman Catholic Church. It was the only language, and it was not Greek. Erasmus, in many places, in many ways, was contrary to his Roman Catholic upbringing, and so that's a very bad misnomer. He was not a run-of-the-mill Roman Catholic, nor was he a real strong, faithful Roman Catholic person. And then as far as his being a humanist, that's again a smear term, as if we're talking about the atheistic humanists of today. A humanist in his day was a person who dealt with humanities and who was for human conditions and human people. It was not the atheistic humanistic thing that we have today. And it's a completely different type of humanism as was practiced in that day and as compared to the present day of what in which we live. And so this humanist philosophy, they're trying to smear him, Roman Catholic humanist, see? But let's not be too hard on Erasmus. But he came to Basel, and he wanted to publish this Greek text. All right, continue. Quote, his publisher, Froben, pressured him to include the Greek New Testament in his work. Unquote. Let me just simply say, I don't know that the publisher pressured him to do so. I believe that he wanted to do so, and I don't believe there was any pressure. Let me continue. Quote, consequently, in 8 months, Erasmus edited his Greek New Testament based on the 7 manuscripts available to him in Basel. Erasmus described his text as thrown together rather than edited, unquote. It had many typographical errors And with regard to these errors, F.H.A. Scrivener said, it is the most faulty book I know, unquote. Now, he's quoting Dr. Scrivener, who is for the Textus Receptus in the traditional text, and he's talking about a text, I'm sure, his first edition. But Erasmus had more than simply one edition. He had 3, 4, or 5 editions of the text, and so it's not right to call the Erasmus text the last final polished variety, the most corrupt text or the most faulty book that he knows. I believe that this was reference to his first edition, and that was hastily got together. He did want to beat the other Greek text that was written by the document called the Complutensian Polyglot, which was from Cardinal Ximenes. He wanted to beat that into publication, into print, so that it could be the first, and Froben did do that, and so he had to work fast. Now, as far as the 7 manuscripts that he had, as far as that's concerned, first of all, I don't know that he had only 7. That's the first thing. I would question that. I'm not positive that that is a factual, true statement. But even if he had 7, they were representatives of the textual, traditional text that underlies the King James Bible and the traditional text that was underlying the manuscript tradition. We have today 5,255, that was in 1967, 5,255 as of 1967 manuscripts. Now these manuscripts, 99% of them, over 99% of them, have the effect of the King James Bible, and they have the effect of being the traditional type of text. Now that's over 99% of them. And simply, Erasmus simply took the 7 that he had as representatives of the vast majority of cursives and other manuscripts that he had in his hands. And it's just like dipping a water from a river that's flowing by. You take a cup from this part and a cup from that part. It's the same river. And so the river of the manuscripts of the Greek New Testament is a similar river. And only less than 1%, the Westcott and Hort type of manuscripts, B and Aleph and about 43 others, less than 1% of the manuscripts that we have today are false and fallacious and polluted and poisonous. And Erasmus picked from the right stream of manuscripts. And let me just simply say that he had many other editions, and the first edition was hastily gotten together. I certainly would agree with that. Let me continue. Quote, of the 7 manuscripts which Erasmus used, none contained the whole New Testament. One was complete except for Revelation, and all the rest had various parts of the New Testament. I had only Revelation. One had only Revelation except for the last 6 verses. 2 had only the Gospels. 2 had only the Epistles. 1 had the Pauline Epistles. All were from the 11th to the 15th centuries, unquote. Let me just pause right there. Well, he had manuscripts that dealt with the entire New Testament. And these manuscripts certainly were available to him, and he used them, and they were of the proper textual base, because the Erasmus Greek text is very little different from other so-called Textus Receptus or received texts from the traditional text families. Very similar to the others. For instance, the Erasmus text is similar to the Complutensian Polyglot. It's similar to the one by Beza. It's similar to Stevens. It's similar to these others, Elsevier as well. And so these all of the so-called traditional text group of documents or editions, the so-called Textus Receptus texts, are very similar. And so Erasmus selected these from the basis of his study and of his travels. As he went from country to country looking at Greek manuscripts, he selected these, and that's very good to have only 6 verses eliminated from his manuscripts that he had. I don't know where he gets this information that he had so many that were from this one and so many from that one, but that's at least what Dr. Glennie has stated. Let me continue. As a result of his editing of these 7 manuscripts, in 1516, Erasmus produced a new Greek text which had never existed before. Remember, the closer manuscripts differ from each other, the closest manuscript, rather, differ from each other 0 to 6 to 10 times per chapter. Let me just simply say this. six to ten times per chapter is a very small difference if you're talking about spellings, and that's exactly what we're talking about. He took the manuscripts that he had available from different parts of the New Testament and edited them to make one new text. He used two main manuscripts, he says, and wrote his corrections and changes on them. And the printer then used these to make the printed text. A comparison of Erasmus' notes and the 1516 edition of the Text Receptus shows that at times the printer did not accept Erasmus' corrections, and at other times he made revisions not made by Erasmus, unquote. Well, whatever he did in 1516, Froben, the printer, is certainly up to Froben and up to Erasmus. And that's not the only thing that we're criticizing. That's not the only part of the Textus Receptus that there is. And Dr. Glennie is zeroing in on Erasmus' first edition, 1516. What about his other editions? Erasmus, as I said, had other editions. He had at least five different editions of the Greek New Testament text. He had a text of 1516, 1519, 1522, 1527, and 1535. Now, if Erasmus had said that his first edition was the only one to have and that's the way to go, that would be one thing. If he did not correct it, Erasmus, which Dr. Glennie does not mention, was the greatest Greek scholar on the European continent of his day. The greatest Greek scholar on the European continent of his day. And he was able, a tremendously able Greek scholar. And to have these five different editions showed that he was not satisfied with his first edition. He went back and corrected and made changes accordingly. And what Dr. Glennie does not say, and what Dr. Scribner did not mean, that none of his editions were of any value, but simply this first one that was in haste, 1516. But what about 1519, 3 years later? 1522, 3 years more later? 1527, 5 years after that? And then 1535, 8 years after that? That's the result of this man's scholarship. From 1516 to 1535, he made some changes, and that's important. He was a scholar of no mean importance. And this is taken, by the way, from the appendix of Dr. Scrivener's Greek New Testament, on page 648, various editions of Erasmus. And so this is not a true picture, being critical, as Dr. Glennie is, of Erasmus and his work. Well, he says, since for the book of Revelation, Erasmus possessed only one manuscript, and that in a commentary, he had a fresh copy of the text of Revelation made, a fresh copy. The copyist made several errors in copying the text of Revelation, which are still found in the Textus Receptus text published today, unquote. Well, I don't believe that those are errors at all. I believe that they differ from the critical text, and we believe the Textus Receptus is correct, and the critical text is incorrect. Well, I want you to get these broadcasts, if you want to, by tape. We'd be glad to have them. Ask your bookstore to get them for you, or we'll tell you how to get the broadcasts. We want you to get our book, Defending the King James Bible. These are important days, and these are important criticisms of the text that underlies our King James Bible and of the King James Bible itself. And we believe that a lot of these statements made by Dr. Glennie and this seminary, the Central Baptist Theological Seminary in Minneapolis, are false. And I believe that ought to be answered, and that's what we're trying to do on these broadcasts. So please continue to stay tuned with us every week and continue to listen and think about these matters that are being criticized and condemned by this professor at this school in Minneapolis. Well, time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 10:9. He said, I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved and shall go in and out and find pasture. Write us. Bible for Today, Collingswood, New Jersey. Or call us on the order phone, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your bookstore to get Defending the King James Bible, or else call us direct. We'll tell you how to get it at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Dr. D.A. Waite, signing off and reminding you, you can have confidence in the King James Bible because the King James Bible is the Bible for today, and it's readable. So long until next broadcast. Don't miss it. We'd like to hear from you. Why not give us a call right now? We now present the Bible for Today of the Air, heard each week at the same time and over the same station, sponsored by the Bible for Today Incorporated and the Dean Burgon Society, with international studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D. Yate, Director of the Bible for Today, speaking. Welcome to weekly broadcast number 526. 526 weeks of weekly broadcasting, standing together with the Dean Burgon Society in defense of traditional Bible texts, including the traditional Masoretic Hebrew Old Testament text, the traditional received Greek New Testament text, and the traditional English text, the King James Bible. We're building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today, and it's readable. Our order phone number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. That's 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on our question and answer phone at 609-854-4452. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like you to get our book called Defending the King James Bible. Ask your bookstore to get it for you, or call us direct. We'll tell you how to get it at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Also, ask us for brochure number one. We'd be glad to send it to you upon request. 1,000 titles that we carry defending the King James Bible and the Greek and Hebrew text that underlies it. All right, we're on this broadcast these last few weeks talking about the book, The Bible Version Debate, the perspective of Central Baptist Theological Seminary located in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Their theme is Shaping Servants for the 21st Century. And we've said on this broadcast, and we mean it, that they are in the area of Bible debate and Bible versions, misshaping servants, rather than shaping, misshaping servants for the 21st century. In the Hebrew text, in the Greek text, they are dead wrong. We're in chapter number 4, talking about the chapter Defining the Terms by W. Edward Glennie. Professor Glennie is writing, and we're there on page number 49, where we stopped last time. If you're interested in getting more broadcasts of other tapes that perhaps you've missed, you can get those also from your bookstore, ask about them, or from us directly at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Talking about the book of Revelation that Erasmus possessed, only one manuscript, he says, and that in a commentary, and he had a fresh copy of the text of Revelation made. The copyist made several errors in copying the text of Revelation, which are still found in the Textus Receptus published today. Well, I don't agree with that. But he states that anyway. Continuing, quote, some of these are words unknown elsewhere in Greek literature, and other words are not found in any known Greek manuscripts. Because Erasmus had no Greek manuscripts containing the last six verses of Revelation, he translated these verses from the Latin Vulgate into Greek. Well, the point of it is, let me just pause right there. Wouldn't you rather have some verses in Greek if you did not have manuscripts in the last six verses of Revelation? That's pretty good. If he had every single other verse covered by a Greek manuscript other than the last six of Revelation, I don't even know whether that is correct. There are people that have doubted that and questioned that. This is the old wives' tale that he lacks six verses from the book of Revelation, the last six. And others have written that he did have Greek manuscripts for those last verses. Indeed. But even if he didn't, wouldn't you rather have him to put the last verses of Revelation in rather than just to leave them out? Furthermore, if you compare the last six verses of Revelation in the Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible and the false Greek text of Westcott and Hort, you will not find too many differences. And if you look at the translations, for instance, of a modern version like the Revised Standard Version of the last six verses of Revelation, and you compare that with the King James Bible, there will not be too many differences that you will notice. A couple of words here and there. And so he did a very good job of it, and other Greek manuscripts were found that went along with Erasmus' translation of the last six verses of Revelation. Continue. Quote, these verses contain at least 20 errors which have no support whatever in any Greek manuscript, and yet are still found in the Textus Receptus today. 20 errors. Well, according to them, they're errors because they have the wrong Greek text before them. And that's a footnote. And, of course, footnote number 30. If you look at footnote number 30, see discussion in Combs and Metzger and so on and so forth. Well, I don't believe that those are errors. I believe that they've got the wrong text, the critical text, and they call anything different from the critical text an error. All right, let's continue. Dr. Glennie says, quote, in Acts 9:6, Erasmus added to his Greek text the words, and he, trembling and astonished, said, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? And the Lord said unto him, unquote. My friends, that is a proper Greek text and a proper verse, and those are proper words. Just because the Westcott and Hort type of text leaves those out, is not any reason to say that there's a doubt about them. They're words that should be there, and words that have a solid backing as far as the Greek text is concerned. And then he says, quote, Erasmus admitted he took those words from the Latin Vulgate. They're not found in any Greek manuscripts at this passage, but are also still found in the edition of the Text Receptus published by the Trinitarian Bible Society, unquote. All right, let me just take a look at Acts 9 and verse 7. This particular verse, Acts 9 and verse 6, were words that were taken from the Latin Vulgate. That is correct. But what is the support for this verse? And Acts 9, 5 and 6 both are part of this. In the book Bible for Today, number 1617, when the KJV departs from the so-called majority text by Dr. Jack Mormon, we find the documentation of these particular verses on page 61, where he reads in Acts 9, 5, and 6, it is hard for thee to kick against the pricks, and he trembling and astonished said, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? And the Lord said unto him, now the Hodges and Farstad and the critical text omit the entire passage, Acts 9, 5, and 6. Now, what is the support for those verses and the parts of verse 5 and the parts of verse 6? Well, the Tyndale Bible has them, the Great Bible, Neva Bible, the Bishop Bible, the Stephen's Greek text, Beza's Greek text, Elzevir Greek text, the Latin, 629. The Old Latin has it, A-R-C-H-L-P-P-H-T. The Vulgate has it, the Clementine and the Fuldensian, and the D-E-M-I-D and the Armenian version, possibly, the Georgian version, the Slavonic version, the Ethiopic, Hilary. Now, these are church fathers. Now, how did these versions get it if there wasn't in any Greek text anywhere at the time? They had it because they were genuine. Now, some of the church fathers that quote from them, Hilary, Patriarchs, Latin 367, Lucifer, Cagliari, Latin 370, Ephraim, Syria, and then 373 is the date of it. Ambrose quotes it, Milan, in Latin 397, Theophylact, Bulgaria, 1077. Hill says that the passage is present at the end of Acts 9:4 and E 431 and the Syriac Peshitta, and so on. So these are some of the bulwarks and the reasons to accept Acts 9, 5, and 6. And so I don't believe that there's any doubt as to the authenticity of these verses. And sometimes, as Dr. Hills has said, in three or four instances, maybe five or six, the Lord has chosen to preserve his words in the Latin and all these other church fathers rather than in the Greek text in some instances. I believe this is an example of that particular effect. From the documentation of Dr. Mormon, you can see it is well attested by church fathers, by early church quotations, by various versions, early versions, as well as other quotations. Many things for that. All right, let me continue. He goes on, Dr. Glennie, he says, quote, the common Johannium, that is the 1 John 5, 7, and 8, the Trinitarian formula in 1 John 5, 7, and 8, which is included in the Text Receptus, is found in only four late manuscripts. Erasmus did not include these verses in the first two editions, 1516, 1519, because they were not found in any Greek manuscripts of 1 John that he had examined. When he received pressure from the Catholic officials, he agreed to include these words, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Ghost, and these three are one, and there are three that bear witness on earth. If they could be found in one Greek manuscript, thus, when Erasmus was presented with the manuscript Codex Montferranus or Gregory 61, he was constrained to put these words in the third edition. Metzger suggests that the Greek manuscript had probably been written in Oxford, 1520, by a Franciscan friar named Froy, who took the disputed words from the Latin Vulgate. Metzger notes that the reading has only been found in four Greek manuscripts, the earliest from the 14th century, and in the margin of four others. The arguments used for the inclusion of the Common Johannium in the Text Receptus in the King James Version are a good example of the thinking and methodology of the King James only advocates. As White notes, There are quite literally hundreds of readings in the New Testament manuscript tradition that have better arguments in their favor and are rejected by both Erasmus and the KJV translators, and yet this passage is defended by KJV-only advocates to this day. It is defended, of course, because it was included in the Textus Receptus. Well, let's take a look at 1 John 5, 7, and 8. This is a questionable passage that he has brought up. There's an entire book on this subject by the man, Michael Maynard. An entire book, 300-some-odd pages, on 1 John 5, 7, and 8. If you're interested in that subject, that's available. But there are also 15 pages that we have by Dr. Jack Mormon, taken from his book, BFT number 1617, When the King James Bible Departs from the So-Called Majority Greek Text. And we've dealt with this before, but on the appendix of that particular book, it's an excellent book, he goes into the details of the 1 John 5, 7, and 8. That's in chapter 6 of his book, beginning at page 115. And whereas Metzger says there's just four that have this particular reading, and the readings, the ones that they say that they have is 61, 16th century manuscript, 88, 629, 635. Now that's all that Metzger and these other critical scholars say contain 1 John 5, 7, and 8. As far as the Trinity is concerned, they have four manuscripts, that's it. But in effect, there are nine manuscripts that refer to 1 John 5, 7, and 8. And Dr. Jack Mormon lists those manuscripts. He lists them on page number 119 of his book. There's number 61 of the 16th century, number 88 in the margin, 221 in the margin, 429 in the margin, 629 in the text, 635 in the margin, 636 in the margin, 918 in the text, 2318 in the text as well. And so these particular manuscripts are listed, and there are five additional ones, in addition to the four that should be cited, and this should be added to that. Now, the NA, Nestle Aland Apparatus, in the Greek text mentioned that other Greek manuscripts contain the readings in the margin. It was from 61 that Erasmus brought the passage into the third edition, 1522. The Complutensian, 1514, containing the passage was a spur to Erasmus eventually inserting it, and he did. And now, in addition to the manuscript evidence, the external evidence for 1 John 5, 7, and 8, Dr. Mormon goes into the quotations from the early church fathers. And that's an important thing to have, an important thing to keep in mind. The early church fathers quoted from this passage, and certainly they knew that they had it in their hands as they were writing to the various churches and the various Christians of that day. And the Eastern Witnesses, for instance, to 1 John 5, 7, and 8, the several Syriac Peshitta manuscripts have it, and that's one of the quotations. Giles Guthier, using two manuscripts, published a Syriac edition, and this edition places the passage in the text. Well, where did the second edition get it? It got it from the Greek text that it had. The first printed edition of the Arminian Bible, published in 1666 by Bishop Uskin, and it contains 1 John 5, 7, and 8. Now, these are versions of the Bible that contain these verses. Where did they get these in their particular version if they did not have them in the Greek text that was before them in that day? The first printed Georgian Bible, published in Moscow, 1743, contains 1 John 5, 7, and 8. And then Scrivener mentions another, a few recent Slavonic manuscripts that have the passage. Regarding the Gothic version, no portion of Acts and Hebrews to Revelation has been known to survive. But these are various versions that contain 1 John 5, 7, and 8. And then there are early Latin witnesses. Those were the Greek witnesses, but they're early Latin witnesses as well that quote and cite the passage. Tertullian, for instance, he died at 220 A.D., and he's often been cited as indicating the father knew of the words. Many deny this, but Tertullian's statement seems to indicate that he had this before him. Cyprian of Carthage, he died in 258, refers very plainly to this disputed words. I and the Father are one. And again, it is written concerning the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and the three are one. Now, these early church fathers, where did they get in 258 A.D. and 220 A.D. these words in 1 John 5, 7, and 8, if they did not have them in their hands in the Greek New Testament originals? Now, that's the strong proof that these are genuine. So we're not shut up only and exclusively to the manuscripts in these areas, but we have other quotations as well. And Priscillian, a Spanish Christian executed on a charge of heresy in AD 385, clearly quotes the words in his book, and so that's 385 AD. Again, the Speculum, a treatise that contains an old Latin text, has these words. And this was written early as well. A creed, as known as Expositio Fidei, quotes this passage as well. And then the passage is found in an old Latin manuscript, the 5th and 6th century. The words are found in the Confession of Faith, drawn up by Eugenius, Bishop of Carthage. And the two works about Vigilius of Thapsus has it in North Africa, 490 A.D. And another one, De Trinitate, of the Trinity, and Contra Variandum, also contain 1 John 5, 7, and 8. Fulgentius of Respe in North Africa, who died in 533 A.D., quotes the passage. So there's a number of things. The early Vulgate manuscripts, Fulgentius, 546, is quoted as a prologue in the General Epistles. And Cassiodorus, 480 to 570 A.D. of Italy, quotes the passage. And so there's a great number of early witnesses to 1 John 5, 7, and 8. And then that's external evidence. Dr. Jack Mormon, you ought to get this. The 15 pages, ask your bookstore to get it for you or call us direct, and we'll tell you how to get it at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. The documentation in proof of 1 John 5, 7, and 8. We'll get it for you, and we'll tell you how to get it, or you can get the entire book when the King James Bible departs from the so-called majority text. A new twist in the continuing attack on the Authorized Version. Bible for Today, number 1617. Get the entire book, or if you want just this section, let us know, and we'll tell you how to get it. But there's internal evidence as well. And if you leave off the portion of 1 John 5, 7, and 8, and you take it out of there, it does not bear syntactical evidence. The syntax or the grammar of the Greek is not as it ought to be. If you include it, it works out fine. And if you take it away, it does not work out fine because of the tenses and because basically of the masculines and feminines and neuters as far as the gender. The gender, as a rule of grammar, normally coincides. If it's masculine, it goes with masculine, neuter goes with neuter, and so on. But if you take out these intervening words, these 24 words that are omitted in 1 John 5, 7, and 8, the genders do not go in together as they ought to. They clash. And so there's internal evidence that shows that those words in 1 John 5, 7, and 8 that are missing should be there. And this is a very powerful argument on page 116 and 117 of Dr. Mormon's book. So you ought to get it. If there's any question on 1 John 5, 7, and 8, but I believe that they are genuine words, regardless of what these men are saying and writing concerning it. Well, let me continue. We're on page 51. Dr. D.A. Wade answering the booklet, the Bible Version Debate, the Perspective of Central Baptist Theological Seminary. I might just simply say that Dr. Glennie here in this chat, on definitional terms, is merely saying things that have been told over and over and over again against the King James Bible. Well, let me continue. Quote, it was noted above that the majority text differs from the text of Receptus in about 2,000 places. Dan Wallace has counted 1,838 differences, or 1,800 differences. That's what we say as well. And we don't go along with the so-called majority text of Hodges and Farstad. We go along with the text of Receptus that underlies our King James Bible. Then he says, quote, before the majority text was published in 1982, its proponents predicted it would differ from the text of Receptus in more than 1,000 places. These facts are important because they demonstrate that proponents of the majority text have recognized for many years that it is not the same as the Textus Receptus. Furthermore, they have not wanted to have their text identified with the text of Eusebius. They realized that several readings in the TR, for example, the passages mentioned earlier, as well as Acts 8:37 and phrases in Revelation 1:6 and so on, are not in the majority text or are different in the majority text than they are in the Textus Receptus, unquote. Well, the majority text people want to distance themselves from the Textus Receptus. Now let them distance themselves if that's what they want. And we want to distance ourselves from the majority text as well. We do not want the majority text to tamper with the Textus Receptus, the received text that came down to us through the centuries. We do not want the majority text to tamper with the Textus Receptus in these 1,800 places. We want to leave them just as they are. Now, every one of the majority of these 1,800 places is dealt with in this book. If you're interested in this so-called majority text issue, you must get When the King James Bible Departs from the So-Called Majority Text. That's Bible for Today, number 1617. 1617. Ask your bookstore to get it for you, or call us direct. We'll tell you how to get it as well. We also have two booklets on seven defects in the so-called majority text that I wrote. And then we have also a booklet, Why Reject the Majority Text, a little booklet analyzing and summing up the book, When the King James Bible Departs from the majority text. But if you really want to have the documentation, and he gives the manuscript authority and a manuscript digest in the back of this book. And he takes up the major portions where the King James Bible differs from the so-called majority text. And in each of these cases, he takes up 370 specific passages and gives the manuscript authority for them. Where the King James Bible's Textus Receptus is about the same or surpasses that of the majority text. All right, let me continue. Quote, it is important to remember that even though the Textus Receptus and the majority text are similar, they are not the same. Well, we agree with that. They are not the same. We don't want them to be the same. Therefore, advocates of the Textus Receptus and the King James Version only position should not use the majority text or the majority Byzantine text type to defend their position. Unquote. Well, we don't use that. We use the traditional text. Now, this text type business we disagree with. There's no such thing as text types. But we use the traditional text that underlies our King James Bible and that was shown to be the text throughout the centuries from the apostolic age to the present. And to say we shouldn't use the Byzantine text type to defend our position is folly. The Textus Receptus is part of Byzantium and part of the majority text, as far as the texts are concerned, the Greek Bible texts and manuscripts, and we can use every single manuscript available. And the majority text, so-called group, does not have any to exclusively use the so-called Byzantine text type. As I said before, as Dean Burgon mentions, there are no text types as such in the Greek manuscripts. They're simply manuscripts that are simply orphans. It's like going into a cemetery, as Dean Burgon has said, and going and seeing 1,000 or 5,000 unmarked graves, where you cannot tell which is related to the other. And that's exactly the same with the Greek manuscripts. And to say that the Textus Receptus can't use any of the manuscripts that are claimed by the Byzantine text type, as they say, is folly. We will use every manuscript that's available, and we believe that it's proper to do so. Let me continue. Proponents of the majority text generally do not desire to be identified with the Textus Receptus or King James Version only position. Well, that's fine. They don't want to be identified with us. We do not want to be identified with them. We certainly, both of us, disagree with Westcott and Hort's methodology in general. We differ with the 5,604 places where Westcott and Hort text changes the Textus Receptus, at least most of the places, but 1,800 changes are made by the so-called majority text of Hodges and Farstad. And it continues, quote, the majority is based on a large textual base, well over 4,000 manuscripts. Let me just pause right there. That is false. The majority text of Hodges and Farstad is based upon about 414 manuscripts that were collated, or not even all of them collated, but examined, partially examined, by a man by the name of von Soden, a German apostate higher critic who had examined some of these texts. And if all 414 of von Soden's readings agree, that still would not be a majority of 5,255, would it? And so this is a foolish thing to say that the majority text is based on a textual base well over 4,000 manuscripts. That is absolutely false. They take 414, and if that says that the reading is there, von Soden says it's there, that's called the so-called M, or the majority text. That's false. And then it says this, the text Receptus is only based on 7 late manuscripts. How foolish can this man be? How absolutely foolish and unreasoning can he be to say that the Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible is based on 7 late manuscripts? Where does he get that? We have 5,210 manuscripts that go along with the text that underlies our King James Bible. That's over 99% of the evidence that is in existence, in 1967 at least, by Kurt Olland. He counted 5,255 manuscripts. They have some more today that they found, maybe 100 or so extra. But the percentages are the same, I'm sure. And he says, this man says that the King James Bible, Textus Receptus that underlies, is based on 7 manuscripts. My friend, where does he get this? This text goes along with all of these different manuscripts, not simply 7. Is 5,210 anything to do with 7? This is preposterous. What he's saying is that the rest of the manuscripts contradict the Textus Receptus. The other 5,255 minus 7, that would be 5,248, are contradictory. That's what he's implying, is it not, to say that it's based on only 7 manuscripts? Where does he get that? That is what they call poppycock. That certainly is foolish folly, and it is absolutely false, erroneous. And for a man to try to convince the students, as he gave this lecture in the so-called Fundamentalist School of Central Baptist Seminary in Minneapolis, he gave these talks to tell the students that the Textus Receptus is based on 7 manuscripts, is ignorance at the highest level. Ignorance at the highest level. 5,210 is the way it is, and not that small amount at all. Well, as they say, figures don't lie, but liars can figure. And I believe that that's exactly what we have here. And this is coming out of a so-called fundamentalist seminary, and they're trying to convince the readers and the listeners in the chapel talks that they have the facts and the truth is on their side. And the Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible is based on 7 manuscripts and their late manuscripts. My friend, when ignorance and when falsity raises its ugly head to that extent, nothing we can do but to forsake the sources that give us these false statements. And I hope you'll forsake the Central Baptist Theological Seminary, have nothing to do with it, send nobody there, and if you're interested in more of our broadcasts that have defeated and answered these matters, and please write us or call us, and we'll tell you how to get them. Well, time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 10:9. He said, I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. Write us, Bible for Today, Collingswood, New Jersey, or call us on the order phone, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your bookstore to get our book, Defending the King James Bible, as well as brochure number 1, or call us direct. We'll tell you how to get both books at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Dr. D.A. Waite, signing off and reminding you, you can have confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. So long until the next broadcast. Don't miss it. We'd like to hear from you. Why not give us a call right now? We now present The Bible for Today of the Air, heard each week at the same time and over the same station, sponsored by the Bible for Today Incorporated and the Dean Burgon Society, with international studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D.A. Waite, director of the Bible for Today, speaking. Welcome to weekly broadcast number 527. 527 weeks of weekly broadcasting, standing together with the Dean Burgon Society in defense of traditional Bible texts, including the traditional Masoretic Hebrew Old Testament text, the traditional received Greek New Testament text, and the traditional English text, the King James Bible. We're building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible because the King James Bible is the Bible for today, and it's readable. The order phone number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on our question and answer phone at 609-854-4452. 609-854-4452. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like you to get our book called Defending the King James Bible. Why not ask your bookstore to get it for you or call us direct. We'll tell you how to get it at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. All right, also ask for brochure number 1. We'll send it to you with our compliments. 1,000 titles plus that stand for the King James Bible and the Greek and Hebrew texts that underlie it. At 1-800-JOHN-10-9, we'll send it to you. We're talking in these last weeks about the Bible Version Debate. It's a book or booklet put out. It's called Perspective of Central Baptist Theological Seminary. That's in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Their theme is Shaping Servants for the 21st Century. And as far as the Greek and Hebrew text and the King James Bible is concerned, they are misshaping servants, in my opinion, for the 21st century. They claim their fundamentalist school at Central Baptist, and as far as I'm concerned, as far as their beliefs on the Greek text and Hebrew text, they are apostates as far as their beliefs on the preservation of the Greek and Hebrew texts. Well, we're on page number 51. We're talking here about chapter 4, a man by the name of Professor Glennie. Professor Glennie writes 4 chapters in this book. He's the lead man, apparently. He's the point man, as they say in the Marines, defining the terms. That's what chapter 4 is about. And so he's defining the terms. And right now he's talking about the so-called majority text. We're on page number 51, and he says this, quote, "The Textus Receptus has several Greek readings which did not exist before 1516 when Erasmus put them in the Bible. And it also differs from the majority text over 1,800 times," unquote. Well, it does differ from the so-called majority text of Hodges and Farstad over 1,800 times. That's correct. But I dispute the statement that the Greek readings were in the Textus Receptus not till 1516 when Erasmus put them in. They were there, and they were in history, and they were in the early church fathers and various other versions. I don't agree with that at all. Let me continue. Quote, "Most of the Textus Receptus readings, which differentiate it from the majority text, are also found in the King James Bible, calling into question any argument for the superiority, let alone the infallibility, of the text of the King James Version." Unquote. Well, let me just pause right there. I believe in the superiority of the King James Bible. I went there to Minneapolis, in the Minneapolis area, and I had a serious seminar defending the King James Bible. And there was Central Baptist Seminary right there in that area of Minneapolis. And I preached and I taught and I took the books, and we had a good time with the pastor there in his church and ministered the Word of God. And I taught very clearly the superiority of our King James Bible. And here he's saying that much less the superiority of the text of the Bible, but let alone the infallibility of the text of the King James Version. Well, if he means the infallibility of the text of the Greek that underlies the King James Bible, I believe it is an infallible situation. That's my personal belief, that the Greek text that underlies our King James Bible has been preserved by God, and that it is God's words, just as John wrote them, Paul wrote them, Peter, and so on. That's my faith. These people can come along and doubt anything they want. I don't say that the King James Bible English is necessarily infallible. I don't use the word infallible. I think it's accurate translation from the infallible Greek text that underlies it. Now, that's my feeling. I believe we've got some infallibility here. Hebrew text that underlies our King James Bible, and the Hebrew man doesn't agree with that. He blasted that from Central Baptist Seminary. I also believe that we have some infallibility as far as the Greek text that underlies the King James Bible. Now, that's my personal opinion. Our Dean Bergon Society does not say those words. They say that the Hebrew and the Greek texts that underlie the King James Bible are the best texts and the closest to the originals. And that's what our belief is in the Dean Bergon Society. But I personally hold, and I go beyond that somewhat, and I say God has preserved those texts in keeping with his promises, and we have them in that area. Well, he's taking up the history of the Textus Receptus next, but on page 52, he has a figure, he calls it, differences between the Textus Receptus and the so-called majority text, 1,838 differences between them. Now, he's probably quoting Dan Wallace on this, but here's the first. The Textus Receptus, he's got a column for the Textus Receptus and a column for the majority text. On the Textus Receptus side, he says, based on 7 manuscripts of the Byzantine text type. 2 errors in that. I don't agree with that at all. First of all, it's not based only and solely on 7 manuscripts. It's based on 5,210 plus manuscripts. Absolutely false, false, and more false. Second error in that statement, there's no such thing as a text type. They're simply manuscripts. I refer to the Byzantines manuscripts because that's what they refer to, but I don't believe it's a text type. It's our manuscripts that agree with the Textus Receptus and the received traditional text that underlies our King James Bible. Well, that's on the Textus Receptus side. In the majority text side, he says, based on about 4,000 manuscripts of Byzantine text type. There's 2 errors in that sentence. First of all, it's not based on all 4,000 manuscripts of the Byzantine text type. It's based on 414 texts that von Soden, that German higher critical rationalist unbeliever of Germany, had as his base. 414 manuscripts, and he didn't even collate all of them. And it's not based. The majority text of Hodges and Farstad is not based on 4,000 manuscripts at all. It's whatever von Soden says is majority. And von Soden doesn't have all of the collations, even of the 414. But how can 414, by presto change-o magic, become 4,000? Would you answer me that? 414 is not a majority of anything, even if all 414 agreed with the particular reading, or disputed a particular reading. So that's the first error in that statement. The second error, based on the manuscripts of the Byzantine text type. There again, I dispute that there are such things as text types. They're simply manuscripts, orphan manuscripts like little orphan Annie. As Dean Burgon so aptly put it, it's a question of going into a graveyard with unmarked graves and to try to decipher which is related to who. Suppose there are 5,000 graves unmarked. Just mounds of earth, unmarked. Do you mean to tell me that you can go in there and you can say this is a type here and this is a type there, and this is related here and this is related there, this is genealogically related, and this is a family here and a family there? You don't know what it is. It could be the entire population of a town was riddled with some type of disease, ptomaine poisoning, or some plague, the bubonic plague, and they were buried in a mass grave. And nobody's necessarily related to anybody. And this is what they're trying to tell you with these text-type situations. It's a nice little neat argument of Westcott and of Hort in order to prove that the small, less than 1% of the evidence is equal to the 100% of the evidence. Now, that's what they use these so-called text types for. They say there are 4 of them. They say that the Byzantine or Syrian or Textus Receptus type is just 1 of 4. And the others are Caesarean and Alexandrian and whatever the other one is. Alexandrian, Caesarean, I don't even keep them straight. And Western, that's the other. Alexandrian, Caesarean, and Western text types. So here you have 3 against 1. The little manuscript text type, the Byzantine, the Syrian, the Textus Receptus. Just 1 against 3. Just think how the 3 can bully that little one. But you know why Westcott and Hort had to do that? They had to have a 3 against 1. Then they have to say the 1 is simply 1 voice against 3 individual voices. But the fact of the matter is that little 1 voice that's supposed to be the 1 text type has got over 99% of the manuscripts behind it, over 5,210 plus. And the 3 have only 45 manuscripts behind it, less than 1% of the evidence. But 3 against 1 is great, doesn't it? But 1% against 90%, 99%, That sounds horrible for these little three, but that's the fact. And so in order for the little three to beat up on the bully, they got to have three against one. The bully is the King James Bible's text that underlies it. The manuscripts, they're orphans, they're not text types. Let me continue. On the next column, the next line, the text receptus, he says, earliest manuscripts, 11th century. And in the so-called majority text, earliest manuscripts, 4th century. Now just wait a minute. The earliest manuscripts of the majority text are the 4th century? Are they trying to, is this man, Dr. Glennie, trying to tell us that the majority text of Hodges and Farstad or of Robinson and Pierpont, there's two majority texts, is he trying to tell us that those are based upon B and Aleph, the Vatican and Sinai manuscripts, the 4th century manuscripts? This guy has got to be kidding. The majority text has nothing to do with the 4th century B and Aleph. And there's only 4th century manuscripts B and Aleph. There's not any that are 4th century except B and Aleph. And those are supposedly 4th century A.D. But to say earliest manuscript is 11th century for the Textus Receptus, again, is fallacious in this respect. It may be the earliest paper of 11th century. That may be true. I don't agree with it. It's earlier than 11th century, I believe. But even, let's suppose for the sake of argument, that's correct. The paper, 11th century paper. But what about the words that go back because of copies of copies of copies of copies, going back to the writings of Paul and James and John? Now, that's my belief. The Textus Receptus goes back, and it's false to say the majority text is based on 4th century Greek manuscripts. Absolutely fallacious. They don't have anything to do with B and Aleph, Vatican and Sinai. And this man, Dr. Glennie, is talking through his hat when he says it. All right, take another line of this two-column attack, or comparison, I should say. He's against both these, the majority text and the Textus Receptus, as far as I can see. The Textus Receptus, he says, contains the Trinitarian formula in 1 John 5, 7, and 8. The majority text, that is, of Hodges and Farstad, does not contain the Trinitarian formula in 1 John 5, 7, and 8. Well, that's correct. That's absolutely correct. The one contains it. That's why the King James Bible contains it. It's based on the Textus Receptus. And the majority text throws it out. Now, the majority text is wrong in throwing it out. Dead wrong. If you're interested in the arguments, and a tiny bit interested, you ought to get our two tracts, booklets, published by the Dean Burgon Society, on the 7 defects of the so-called majority text. And if you're still a little bit interested, get a second booklet published by our Dean Burgon Society, written by your speaker, both of these, Why Reject the Majority Text, so-called majority text. Now, that's if you have a little interest. Ask your bookstore to get these two booklets, 7 defects of the majority text, Why Reject the Majority Text, or call us direct. We'll tell you how to get them at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Now, if you have a big interest, a gigantic interest in, well, let's say just a big interest, not a gigantic one yet. Let me say just have a big interest, not just a tiny one, but a big one. You ought to ask for the book by Dr. Jack Mormon, When the Majority Text, to the King James Version rather, starts from the so-called majority text, number 1617. When the King James Version departs from the so-called majority text. Now, you ought to get that. That's a big book. That's a big book with over 115 or 20 pages, and you ought to get it. If you have a big interest, little interest, get these two little tracts, 7 defects in the majority text, or Why Reject the Majority Text. A big interest, get that book by Dr. Jack Mormon, When the King James Bible Departs from the So-Called Majority Text. Now, if you have a gigantic interest in 1 John 5, 7, 8, get Michael Maynard's book that we carry, on the defense, the historical defense, over 300 or 400 pages, just zeroing in on 1 John 5, 7, and 8. You can get that from your bookstore, ask them to get it for you, or call us direct. We'll tell you how to get it at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. All right, let's go to the next comparison between the Textus Receptus and the majority text, so-called. The Textus Receptus contains Acts 8:37 and Luke 17:36. The majority text does not contain Acts 37 and Luke 17:36. Well, what's the difference? The majority text is wrong. The Textus Receptus and the King James Bible are right in this particular section, two verses in question. And this is the thing that is wrong as far as the majority text is concerned. The majority text does not have Luke 17:36, for instance. And 17:36 simply says that two men shall be in the field, the one shall be taken and the other left. Nestle-Aland Greek text leaves it out, and the Nestle-Aland as well as the Byzantine text leaves it out, and the New King James has it, but the text that underlies the majority text takes it out. And this is a sad thing indeed, to leave that particular verse. It has good Greek manuscript backing, and the other one is Acts 8:37. And Acts 8:37 has been attacked many times, but you look at the context of Acts 8:37, which says, "And Philip said, if thou believest with all thine heart, thou mayest. And he answered and said, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God." And the manuscript evidence is strong for Acts 8:37. Acts 8:36 says, "And they went their way, and they came into a certain water, and the eunuch said, See, here is water. What doth hinder me to be baptized? And Philip said, If thou believest with all thine heart, thou mayest." But if he didn't have that, you'd simply say verse 38, "And he commanded the chariot to stand still, and they went down both into the water, and both Philip and the eunuch, and he baptized him." It would just simply say, what to the enemy to be baptized? He went down and baptized him without any profession of faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, that's not Christian. That's not the way it ought to be at all. And that's not the way that the formula should work. Everyone who believes in the Lord Jesus Christ is a candidate for baptism. That's correct. But not those simply want to be baptized and go down into the water and be baptized at all. And there's great, on page number 68, 2 of this book I told you about, if you really have a great interest, When the King James Bible Departs from So-Called Majority Text, Dr. Jack Mormon's book number 1617. On page 62, or rather page 60, he has the documentation and the manuscript authority for the verse in question. And it is no question about it. It's solid as far as documentation, and they should hearken unto it and not throw it out. Von Soden indicates several other things as well. But Tyndale has it, the Great Bible has it, the Geneva Bible, the Bishop's Bible, the Stephen's Bible, text, the Greek text, the Beza's text, the Elzevir text, and the various texts of Receptus men have Acts 6, or rather chapter 8 and verse 37. So I believe it ought to be there, and these other men and the so-called majority texts throw it out in conjunction with and after the Nestle-Aland text of the critical text. They go right along with that in the so-called majority text. Well, let's continue. The Textus Receptus in this column contains, it says, a large portion of Acts 9:6 and a phrase of 9:5. But the majority text, so-called, does not contain a large portion of Acts 9:6 and a phrase in 9:5. Well, what is the 9:6 of Acts? Well, if you look at Acts 9:6 and see what it is, you will find that it has to do with the calling of the Lord Jesus, Lord. That's what it is. And he, trembling and astonished, said, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? And the Lord said unto him, Arise and go into the city, and it shall be told thee what thou should do. And this is the issue. This is the issue. The issue is Lord or not Lord. Now, that's an important part. The Nestle-Aland text says he, trembling and so on, went in, but he didn't went into the city, but there's nothing about, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? It's gone. And so it's gone from those versions that don't believe in the text that underlies our King James Bible. And the majority text is one of them. And it simply says, See, enter into the city, rise and enter into the city, and it shall be told thee what thou must do. And the next part is gone from the false texts and the false versions, American Standard Version, various other versions,
the portion that is gone of Acts 9:6 is, "And the Lord said unto him, Arise and go into the city." Now, for instance, if you take the New American Standard Version, it simply says in Acts 9:6, "But arise and enter the city, and it shall be told what you must do." And it omits, "And the Lord said unto him, Arise and go into the city." And it omits, "He trembling and astonished said, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do?" A tremendous thing to preach on. The New Century Version leaves it off. They just simply say, "Get up now and go into the city." But it doesn't say anything about trembling and astonished. This is in Paul's conversion in Acts chapter 9. The New International Version leaves it out. They don't say, "He trembling and astonished said, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do?" And he just simply say, they simply say, "Now get up and go to the city." And so on. Now the New King James does say, "He trembling and astonished said, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do?" And so on. But the New Revised Standard Version of the modernists doesn't have it. They just simply get up and go into the end of the city and so on, but not trembling and astonished. The Revised Standard Version leaves it out. All these leave it out. And to have the majority text leave it out is a strange thing indeed as well. Now, they also say that there's a difference between the text receptus, not only in Acts 9:6, and a phrase in Acts 9:5. So if you back it up one single verse from Acts 9:6 to Acts 9:5, it says, "And he trembling and astonished," no, "and he said, What? Who art thou, Lord? And the Lord said, I am Jesus, whom thou persecutest. It is hard for thee to kick against the pricks." Now, the Revised Standard Version said, "He said, Who are you, Lord? And he said, I am Jesus." Now, that difference is not simply one phrase, but "and the Lord said." The Lord is omitted by the Revised Standard Version, because they don't believe in the proper Greek text. Because it doesn't say so in the Nestle-Aland 26th edition critical text at all. And the same thing is in the Spanish, New Spanish, Reina Valera Actualizada. In other words, the modern Spanish version. It doesn't say, "Lord said." The Lord said. Simply, "He responded. He said." But in the Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible, the Greek text is Kurios. Apen, "and the Lord said," definitely, there it is. And as far as it's in the Stevens text of 1550, that text is Receptus. Kurios, apen, "the Lord said." But you won't find it in the American Standard Version of 1901. Simply, "He said." That's all, "He said," but not "the Lord said." And you'll find it in the New American Standard Version. It won't be, "and it's not the Lord said, but He said." It takes away the lordship of the Lord Jesus Christ. And it's just simply here in the New Century Version, "the voice answered." It doesn't even say "he said." It says "the voice answered." There's no voice in there. And the New International Version, "I am Jesus," instead of saying "the Lord said, I am Jesus." It doesn't even say "he said." It says simply "I said." Now the phrase that they're talking about in Acts 9:5, "it is hard for thee to kick against the pricks." It is hard for thee to kick against the pricks. That is gone. That phrase is out of there. But that phrase has every bit as much validity to be in there as to be out of there, Dr. Jack Mormon has said in his manuscript Evidence and Authority. And you ought to get it. That's in Acts 9 and verse 5. And he has a manuscript digest in the back of his excellent book, "When the King James Version Departs from the So-Called Majority Text." And you look that up in Acts chapter 9 and verse 5 and 6, and you'll find it on page 61. Page 61. And he gives the evidence for that, and he takes a stand on it so that you can agree with it as far as the kicking against the pricks, and also trembling and said, "Lord, what wilt thou have me to do?" It's sound, and the majority text takes it out. Well, we believe it should be defended, as Dr. Jack Mormon has done. Well, let's take another sentence here, comparison between the text receptus and the majority text, so-called. The text receptus contains the questionable section in Acts 34, or rather 24, 6b to 8a. But the majority text does not contain the questionable section in Acts 24, 6b to 6a. Well, what is Acts 24, 6? If you look it up and you find Acts 24 and you take a look at 24 and verse 6, you have also about to profane the temple, whom we took and would have judged according to our law. But the chief captain For instance, particular verse 7 now, but the chief captain, Lysias, came upon us and with great violence took him away out of our hands. Now that verse 7 is gone from the Nestle-Allen text. It's gone from the New International Version. It's gone from the New Century Version. It's just a blank. Now the New American Standard Version has it in with a big footnote. They don't really want it. Lysias the commander came along and with much violence took him out of their hands. The New American Standard Version has it. The Nestle-Allen Greek text takes it out. The Byzantine Majority text takes out verse 7. The American Standard Version of 1901 has it in there. They have no problem with it. All of a sudden they have these doubts. Stephen's 1550 text keeps it in. The Scrivener's text that underlies our King James Bible keeps it in. Chapter 24 of Acts, verse 7. The modern Spanish version, Reina Valera Actual y Sala, takes it out. They don't want it. The Revised Standard Version omits it. And the New Revised Standard Version omits verse 7. So the majority text has taken its place and taken its stand with the modern perversions of our day. And we believe that that is, should be stopped. The stand is there, and the evidence is there, and we ought to keep it, 24:6 to 8 of Acts. And this is something that the King James Bible has in because it is valid and because it should not be doubted and it should not be taken away. And there's parts of verse 9 of Acts 24 that also should be in. So we believe that these verses should be corrected and the text receptus is fine. We ought to leave these things in. Well, we've been talking about some of these comparisons between the text receptus and the majority Greek text, so-called, of Hodges and Farstead. One more and then we'll close for the day. The text receptus contains Acts 15:34, and the so-called majority text of Hodges and Farstead does not contain Acts 15:34. And so here they're vying for power. They're vying for who's got what, which twin has got the Tony, as far as these various verses are concerned. And these comparisons are correct. I'm not doubting the fact that these are different between the text receptus that underlies our King James Bible and the so-called majority Greek text. But my position is the majority Greek text is wrong, and the text that underlies our King James Bible is correct, and the King James Bible itself is correct in using these verses. And that is the consistent of our position. We're not going to forsake the Textus Receptus, the Greek text that underlies our King James Bible. And we're not going to forsake the Greek text that underlies the King James Bible, the Textus Receptus of Beza, 5th edition, 1598. We believe that that should stay as it is. And we're going to continue this next time. We hope that you'll continue. We hope that you'll stay with us, those of you who are listening. Now, this is tough sledding. It's got lots of detail. It's a lot of technical material. And some of you lay people, perhaps, that don't have as much of an interest in this, probably have turned us off before we're even getting to this point. But we're going to continue to stand for and defend not only the King James Bible, but the Greek and Hebrew texts that underlie it. And we do not believe that a fundamentalist school such as Central Baptist Seminary that it calls itself should dispute and take away the text of our Bible and our King James Bible and refute it. We don't believe it at all. Well, time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 10:9. He said, I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved and shall go in and out and find pasture. Write us, Bible for Today, Collingswood, New Jersey, or call us on the order phone, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your bookstore to get our book, Defending the King James Bible, and brochure number 1, 1,000 Titles Defending. Or call us direct. We'll tell you how to get both titles at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Dr. D.A. Waite, signing off and reminding you, you can have confidence in the King James Bible, for the King James Bible is the Bible for today, and it's readable. So long until next broadcast. Don't miss it. Why not give us a call right now? We now present the Bible for Today of the Air, heard each week at the same time and over the same station, sponsored by the Bible for Today Incorporated and the Dean Burgon Society with international studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D.A. Waite, Director of the Bible for Today, speaking. Welcome to weekly broadcast number 528. 528 weeks of weekly broadcasting, standing together with the Dean Burgon Society in defense of traditional Bible texts, including the traditional Masoretic Hebrew Old Testament text, the traditional Greek New Testament text, and the traditional English text,
the King James Bible. We're building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today, and it's readable. The order for number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. That's 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on our question and answer phone at 609-854-452. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like you to get our book called Defending the King James Bible. Ask your bookstore to get it for you or call us direct. We'll tell you how to get that at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Also ask for our brochure number 1, giving over 1,000 titles that we carry defending the King James Bible and the Hebrew and Greek texts that underlie it. That's yours for the asking. We're defending now the King James Bible and the Textus Receptus and the Masoretic Hebrew text that underlies it against this book we've been talking about these last few weeks, the Bible Version Debate, the perspective of the Central Baptist Theological Seminary in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Their theme is Shaping Servants for the 21st Century. We believe they're misshaping the servants because of their stand or lack of stand on the Greek text that underlies our King James, the Hebrew text that underlies our King James, and the King James Bible itself. All right, we're on this chart. We're comparing differences between the so-called Textus Receptus and the so-called majority text of Hodges and Farstad. Over 1,800 differences between them. Well, we agree with that. There are differences. And it says in Ephesians 1:18, the Textus Receptus, the eyes of your understanding. Ephesians 1:18, the eyes of your heart in the majority text. We believe the majority text is wrong, and the King James Bible's Textus Receptus is right. And then in Ephesians 3 and verse 9, the fellowship of the mystery is changed into the majority text, the administration of the ministry, of the mystery, instead of the fellowship. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 19, the Textus Receptus, everyone that nameth the name of Christ, and 2 Timothy 2:19, the so-called majority text, everyone that name of the Lord. Everyone that name of the Lord. I don't know what it means, names of the Lord. Doesn't seem like it makes sense here, but that's what they have in the book here. Well, again, the Textus Receptus is correct. And then Revelation 22:19, the book of life is the Textus Receptus, the tree of life, the so-called majority text. Well, so much for the differences, and we believe that the majority text is wrong. It is wrong. The Hodges and Farstad majority text, as well as the Pierpont and the Robinson majority text. They're two majority texts. They can't even agree among themselves. But we'll stand with the Textus Receptus. All right, we continue now. We're on page number 53. And this is chapter 4 in this book. And it's by Dr. Glennie. And chapter 4, The Defining of Terms. Defining the Terms. Now he goes on and talks about, at this particular juncture, the history of the Textus Receptus. He says this, quote, the Textus Receptus, published today by the Trinitarian Bible Society, 1516, 1519, 1522, 1527, 1535, of the Greek text of Desiderius Erasmus, 1469 to 1536. Well, that's just as false as the day is long. If anybody will look at the Trinitarian Bible Society and the preface to that particular printed edition, which we carry, it's Bible for Today, number 471. If anyone will look at the printed edition of the Trinitarian Bible Society's Textus Receptus, he will find that this is false. It's not based upon the Erasmus text at all. It's based upon Beza's text, 5th edition, 1598. This is an incorrect statement, and it ought to be corrected in the minds of everyone that is listening. Let me continue. The Greek text was changed in his second edition. Erasmus added the Trinitarian formula in 1 John 5, 7, and 8 to his third edition. And in the fourth, he altered the text of Revelation to about 90, in about 90 places, with changes based on the Complutensian polyglot. His fourth and the definitive edition became the basis, TR, or Textus Receptus. And that is just as false, again, as the day is long. The Complutensian Polyglot was a traditional text type of manuscript edition. And the Complutensian Polyglot, well, came out about the same time as Erasmus did, from Cardinal Ximenes, also a Roman Catholic cardinal, and his text was a Textus Receptus type of text. But the text that was followed by the Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible was not Erasmus' text. It was not the Complutensian Polyglot text. It was the text of Beza, 5th edition, 1598. Let me continue. He's going to go on. He's got to knock Erasmus. This man, Dr. Glennie, has got to knock Erasmus as the Greek scholar that he was, the best in the continent of his day. He's got to smash him. He's got to align the King James Bible's Textus Receptus with Erasmus and then knock it down. But he is wrong in that. Let me continue. Erasmus' editions of the Greek New Testament, especially the 1527 and 1535 editions, were the basis of four editions of the Greek text published by Robert Etienne, 1505 to 1559, who is better known by his Latin name, Stephanus. Stephanus' third and fourth editions, 1550 and 1551, which are close to Erasmus' 1527-1535 edition, than Stephanus' other editions are, became the standard text of the Greek New Testament for many people, especially in England. Unquote. Let me stop right there. Well, that may be the case. Stephen's traditional text for Textus Receptus is one of the four or five that name have that name, and that's very similar to Beza. It's very similar. There are some changes, however, and you'll notice that our interlinear Greek New Testament with the Textus Receptus of Stephen's 1550 and the King James Bible in the margin has some differences with the text of Beza, 5th edition, 1598, and that which underlies our King James Bible. But Stephen's was a reliable text in general. It was a Textus Receptus in general. Let me continue. Quote, Stephanus included various readings in his text from about a dozen Greek manuscripts and the Complutensian Polyglot, showing that, like Erasmus, he was not adverse to considering variants in the Greek text. Now, let me unquote. Let me continue. Quote, Theodore Beza, 1519 to 1605, is the third key link in the development of the Textus Receptus. Beza was John Calvin's friend and successor at Geneva. He published 11 editions of the Greek New Testament, the first 1564. He used Stephanus' lists of variant readings and added none of his own, more of his own, from other manuscripts. At times, he edited the text based on his own conjecture, such as Revelation 16:5, where he changed who art and who wast, O Holy One, to which art and wast and shall be, a reading found in the King James Version, which had no Greek manuscripts supporting it, which has no Greek manuscripts supporting it. Well, the King James Textus Receptus, I'll go by and I say it's correct, and no problem with that rendering in Revelation 16:5. Looking at Dr. Jack Mormon's excellent book, When the King James Bible Departs from the So-Called Majority Text, Bible for Today, number 1617. It's available. Ask your bookstore to get it for you or call us direct. You need it. It's got a manuscript digest in the back of a book, page 102. He has Revelation, and that's the one that he's talking about, 16 and verse 5, which art and wast and shall be the Holy One, Beza. The King James Bible rendering, he says, is in harmony with the four other places in Revelation where this phrase is found. In Revelation 1:4, 1:8, and 4:8. Indeed, Christ is the Holy One. But in the scriptures of the Apostle John, the title is found only once. 1 John 2:20, and so on. So he has these things, and he talks about them, and he says that there's no problem with it. With the former translations diligently compared and revised, the translators must have felt there was good reason to insert these words, though it ran counter to much external evidence. They obviously did not believe the change made today, that Beza inserted it on the basis of conjectural emendation. He does not believe that the charge made today that Beza inserted on conjectural emendation. The Textus Receptus men, the King James Bible translators, in other words, did not believe this was conjectural at all. They knew that they were translating the Word of God, and so do we. The logic of faith should lead us to see God's guiding and providence in a passage such as this. In other words, it was in conformity exactly with Revelation 1:4, 1:8, and 4:8. That's a good comment on this particular section as mentioned here. Let me continue. Beza's Greek text hardly differs from Stephanus' 4th edition, 1551, well, it does sometimes, and the King James Bible translators used Beza's editions
extensively completing their translation in 1611, unquote. Not only did they use Beza's editions extensively, but it was basically the fifth edition of Beza, 1598, that was the basis of the King James Bible. And these men ought to get their facts straight. 1598, fifth edition, Beza, B-E-Z-A. Not Erasmus, not the Complutensian. Now, they did have a few uses of some of these other versions, but the basis, there's only 190 places that Dr. Frederick Scrivener, who examined this and who has a Greek New Testament text based upon the text that underlies the King James Bible with the variant readings of the Westcott and Hort Greek text, and in the appendix of that, as we've said many times on the broadcast, he lists about 190 places where the King James translators did not choose to use Beza's 5th edition, 1598. And these places, 7, 8, or 9 of them, different texts instead of Beza, are used, but over 99% is Beza. If only 190 places, and there are over 180,000 Greek words in the Greek New Testament, 140,000, I guess it is, this is a very minute portion that was not based on Beza's edition 1598. Let me continue. Quote, Zane Hodges rightly warns that, quote, it is important to keep in mind that in speaking of the text of Eusebius, we are talking about an entity which, to this day, retains a certain fluidity. There are more than 25 early editions of the received text, all varying slightly one from the other. No absolutely definitive edition of it yet exists, unquote. Well, let me just simply say this. If there's no definitive edition of the text of Eusebius, there are 25 different early editions of the received text, that's fine. He can have this way in that. He can say that. And Hodges, who's the editor here of the Hodges and Farstad so-called majority Greek text that changes the text of Eusebius in 1,800 places, he can believe that. Dr. Glennie of Central Baptist Theological Seminary in Minneapolis can believe that. But I happen to take my stand on the text that underlies our King James Bible. Now, they can take their stand and say no text is right, no text has been preserved. I just simply, by faith, accept that text that Dr. Scrivener has produced. It's the text that has been written and reproduced and put into a book in the Trinitarian Bible Society. And that text is the text, basically, of Beza 5th and 1598. I believe that's the text that is the standard and should be the standard. And that's the text that's been printed and reprinted into the thousands of copies that we have today. And that's the exact text that underlies our King James Bible. And I'm going to stick to it. These men can say it's fluid. These men can say they don't believe any text is accurate in the text Receptus family. But I believe that that's the one that is, and I'm going to accept it by faith. All right, you can shoot me if you wish, but that's my belief, and I'm going to stand firmly upon it. All right, let me continue. Quote, this also is a good time to point out that the translators of the King James Version used several sources, mainly Erasmus, Stephanus, and Beza's texts. And when these texts differed, the translators chose between the various readings, unquote. Let me just pause right here. It's almost as if Glennie is saying that they had almost a third of Erasmus, a third of Stephanus, and a third of Beza as far as the text. And that is false and fallacious. Let me repeat again. The basic text that underlies our King James Bible is not Erasmus, is not Stephen's. It is Beza's 5th edition, 1598. Now, it so happens that Stephen's and Beza agree for the most part, and Stephen's Erasmus agree with Beza for the most part. But it is Beza, 5th edition, 1598, that they took as the one to use. And I want to make that very clear. Let me continue. Quote, it is noteworthy that the name Textus Receptus was first applied to this textual tradition in 1633, 2 decades after the publication of the King James Version. All right, let me just pause right here. What he's saying is maybe the King James Version did not use the Textus Receptus because that term, that name, didn't come into being until 1633, which was after the King James came out. My friend, the Textus Receptus, just because it was in Latin, Textum Receptum, was used by 1633 Elzevir in the publication, does not mean that that was the beginning of the Textus Receptus or the received text. That's merely the title. This is the traditional text that originated with Paul and Peter and John and James and all the writers of the New Testament. That's the traditional text. And what Elzevir brothers were saying in their Latin phrase, this is a text which has been received by all. A textum receptum received by omnibus. All people up to that point had received this text. And the text that was a popular text, in other words. And just because the word, the Latin word textus receptus, or textum receptum, whatever it is, in the Latin phrase, was used in 1633, and that was 2 decades or 20 years after the King James Bible, does not mean that the King James Bible was not derived from that same received Greek text. That's what they're trying to point out and making a little bit of a humorous jest at this point. Let me continue. Quote, at that time, the Elzevirs, that is 1633, published the second edition of their Greek New Testament with the publisher's blurb in the preface that this is the text now received by all. In Latin, the words were for text and received are textum and receptum, or receptum, from which is derived the phrase textus receptus, or received text. The 1633 edition mainly followed Beza's text that also used Stephanus and other sources. See figure 4b. Figure 4b. Well, he goes into some of the things in that particular figure. Let me point out again, unquote, that the text that underlies our King James Bible is not basically Erasmus. It's not basically Stevens. It is basically Beza, 5th edition, 1598. That text that basically underlies our King James Bible. And for the other portions, the other ones that were consulted, Dr. Scrivener, in the appendix of his book, and you ought to get that book, The Greek Text That Underlies Our King James Bible by Dr. Frederick F.H. Scrivener. Frederick H.A., I guess it is, Scrivener, and that can be available. Ask your bookstore to get it for you or call us direct at the Bible for Today, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For the sake of completeness in the broadcast, let me simply list one of the other places of these 190 spots that Dr. Scrivener has listed where the King James Bible translators departed from the Beza's 5th edition, 1598. On the back of the appendix, there are these 10 different things that they used rather than Beza. But it's only 190 out of 140,000, which is a very small percentage. They used occasionally the Complutensian Polyglot, 1514. They used occasionally Erasmus text, either 1516, 1519, 1522, 27, 1535. They used in the third place Aldus, 1518, sometimes Colinaeus, 1534, and sometimes in the fifth place Stephanus, 1546, 49, 50, 51. In the sixth place Plant in Antwerp, the Antwerp Polyglot, 1572. In the seventh place Beza's, 1560, 1565, 1582, 1589, 1598. And the 8th, the Vulgate Latin, the 9th, Tyndale's English, 1526, or 10th, the Authorized Version, 1611. And so these are some of the things that were the sources that were consulted by Dr. Scrivener, according to his appendix, page 648. And he has told us that some places they did depart from Beza's 5th edition, 1598, but not in very many places. All right, let me continue. Quote, the development of the text receptus from Erasmus to Stephanus to Beza to the Elzevirs made it inadmissible to claim inspiration or perfect preservation for the TR or the King James, as some King James Version-only advocates do today. Unquote. Well, let me just say just simply this. I believe, now it's personal opinion, the Dedenbergon Society believes that the Masoretic text that underlies our King James Old Testament is the closest to the original that can be made. They believe also that the Dedenbergon Society, of which I'm president here these last 19 years, almost 20 going up, we believe that the closest in the Greek text is the text that underlies James Bible. Now, that's the Dedenbergon Society position. I personally believe that the Masoretic text that underlies our Old Testament, King James Bible, has been preserved by God, and I would say that that's been preserved inerrantly, infallibly, and that's God's preservation, and that's the text. Now, that's a personal thing on faith that I believe. I believe the same for the New Testament. The Greek text that underlies our King James Bible, I believe God has preserved and that's been preserved inerrantly. And so the Greek text is an inerrant preservation of what Paul wrote, Peter wrote, John, and so on. And I believe that, personally, we must take a position and we must have faith that God kept his promise to preserve his words. And we also must believe that he has given us in our hands that copy of the Hebrew and Greek scriptures that we can use as the basis for translating God's words into all the languages of the world. If you don't have a base and you don't know what to use in the Hebrew or what to use in the Greek, how can you translate God's words into any language, whether it's English or Spanish or French or German or whatever? And so that's my personal belief that's the case. And there's been a development, yes, in the Textus Receptus. And I believe that at that point in time when the King James translators translated English language, that excellent translation that they made, our King James Bible, I believe at that time the Textus Receptus had developed so that it was the one that we ought to have and use and back completely. Let me continue. Quote, furthermore, the standard edition of the Textus Receptus used today, published by the Trinitarian Bible Society, is not identical to any of the editions of the Textus Receptus we have been discussing, but is an eclectic text which draws its reading from different sources. Unquote. Let me just pause right there. Different sources. Now, let me just simply say that this text, and I had a hand in getting that text printed and published, by the way, in the Trinitarian Bible Society. I thought it ought to be made available to people way back when it was first printed. And one of our friends gave, I believe, over $1,000 to that project and urged England to put this into printed form. And they did it. And it's a good thing that they did. And this is a very popular New Testament Textus Receptus. It's available here from the Bible for Today. It's BFT number 471. We are one of the distributors of that in this country. And we take proud cognizance of that. We're glad to do it. And we're glad that we can serve the Lord in a way. And that's 471. You can ask your bookstore to get it for you or call us direct. We'll tell you how to get it. But that Textus Receptus is not eclectic in that sense. It is the exact text that underlies our King James Bible. And it's the exact text of Dr. Frederick Scrivener that he produced at the insistence and the request of the University of Cambridge, Cambridge University Press, to get a text out, a Greek text, that exactly underlies the King James Bible. And also in that same text to indicate the exact places where the Westcott and Hort Greek text has departed from the Textus Receptus. And that's exactly what was made. And so by saying these snide remarks that it's no text is identical to that of the Trinitarian Bible Society's text, and that it's an eclectic text drawn from readings from different sources, that sounds like it's a horrible, horrible animal, does it not? And it's not true. The basic text is Beza, 1598, 5th edition. And it's exactly the text of Dr. Scrivener that he produced in that time. And so I would not agree that this is making such a slight of this text that underlies our King James Bible. Let me continue. Quote, the modern textus could be called a made-up text, which in the case of variants determines what readings to include by following the English King James Version. The history of the Textus Receptus leaves no doubt that its text has changed many times. This is a major problem for those who would claim that it exactly represents the originals. Unquote. Well, there's no problem for me. I believe it does represent the originals. That's my personal belief. And he's going to quote me. Don't go away. Let's get a quote here. Yet, now listen, that doesn't make any problem at all. As far as I'm concerned, God providentially preserved and led his translators to use the Greek text that was up to date, that was proper, that was a condensation of those things that were given from the traditional text right on down to the present of 1611 when they made that particular text. Notice, yet D.A. Waite declares, in fact, now notice this, now he's going to quote me, we're on page 56 of this book, quote, it is my own personal conviction and belief after studying this subject since 1971, that the words of the received text, the received Greek and Masoretic Hebrew text that underlie the King James Bible, are the very words which God has preserved down through the centuries, being the exact words of the originals themselves, unquote. Emphasis is weight. All right, that's a quotation from my book, Defending the King James Bible. And I do believe that. That is my personal belief. I've set it aside as different from the text, the belief of the Dean Burgon Society. They do not hold to this belief that I have outlined here. As I said before in the broadcast, they believe that the closest text, the Hebrew, Masoretic Hebrew text that underlies the King James Bible, the closest text to the Hebrew is that one. And the closest text to the Greek is the Textus Receptus that underlies the King James Bible. But they do not hold my belief specifically. That's personal. But it is my belief that God preserved those very words. Similarly, Thomas Strauss claims the TR is essentially equivalent to the autographs. That's the emphasis there. And he quotes Dr. Strauss. So both of us, in fact, Dr. Strauss called me about this not too long ago. And he mentioned to me that they had quoted him in the same breath that they quoted me. Which, that's interesting, isn't it? And so we're fellow members of the Textus Receptus family that stand for this Greek text that underlies our King James Bible. And Dr. Strauss is on our advisory council of our Dean Burgon Society, and we're very glad that he is, and he's a student of the Word of God and the So they make this foolish thing. In fact, this was given at the chapel services in Central Baptist Theological Seminary. And I had at that time, when it was given at this chapel service, before it was into this book, one of the students called me and said, "Now, is that your belief? Now, this is what was quoted." I said, "It's exactly my belief. That was quoted from my book, Defending the King James Bible, and that's exactly what I wrote, and that's what I believe." And I explained to this student why I held to that position. God promised to preserve his words. I believe he did. And I believe that's what we ought to use, and that's what we ought to go by, what he has preserved. Well, you can see that this is a battle. I can continue a little bit. He said, "In the light of the historical evidence, such statements have no foundation." That's what he said. Well, that's fine. He can have anything he wants. Which edition or revision of the Textus Receptus are these men talking about? My friend, it says what I'm talking about. The idea I said is to receive Greek and Masoretic Hebrew texts that underlie the King James Bible. That's the exact text I'm talking about. And that's the text of Bankaim in the Hebrew. And that's the text that underlies the King James Bible, which is printed by the Trinitarian Bible Society, the text of Scrivener in the Greek. We have identified the text. We know exactly which Greek text we're talking about. And so that is what we believe. Well, I hope that you'll stay tuned to these broadcasts each week. It's technical, but I think it has to be answered. We cannot have Central Baptist Theological Seminary hammering away against the text that underlies our King James Bible in the Hebrew or in the Greek. Nor can we have the Central Baptist Theological Seminary hammering away successfully at the King James Bible itself. And yet that's what they're doing. They're undermining the faith of those of us who stand for the King James Bible and the Hebrew and Greek texts that underlie it. Shame on them in Central Baptist Theological Seminary. And we differ with them completely, and it leads to unbelief, to doubt, and Satan is happy, and God is displeased. Well, time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ? In John 10:9, he said, "I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out, and find pasture." Write us, Bible for Today, Collingswood, New Jersey, or call us on the order phone, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your bookstore to get our book, Defending the King James Bible, as well as Brochure 1, giving 1,000 titles defending the King James. Or call us direct. We'll tell you how to get both titles at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Dr. D.A. Waite, signing off and reminding you, you can have confidence in the King James Bible because the King James Bible, the Bible for today, and it's readable. So long until next broadcast. Don't miss it. We'd like to hear from you. Why not give us a call right now?